Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have David Seeloff with us. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And right now, we're doing our series, People, the People That History Forgot. And tonight will be parts 5 and 6 and maybe 7. So here we go with David Seeloff. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. It's great to be back once again.
Yes.
And the title of chapter 5 is The New Testament Provides the Key. And, of course, it's the key to the people that history forgot. And the words I'm reading are those of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. Mixing pagan themes with Jewish ones in synagogue worship services is referred to by the Apostle John in the book of Revelation. He speaks about those who worship in the synagogue of Satan in Revelation 2 and verse 8 and Revelation 3 and verse 9. Now, John's reference was not intended as a figure of speech. To John, that type of synagogue was in existence in the period of his writing. In other words, when he was writing. John depicts those who worship at such synagogues as heretics, quote, which say they are Jews and are not. And this is in Revelation 2 and verse 8. And further, John said they were people, quote, who say they are Jews and are not, but do lie, end quote.
Yeah.
In Revelation 3, 9. They had gone so far away from the simple truth, as John conceived it, that they were eating food sacrificed to idols. This is in Revelation 2 and verse 14. These strictures of John were not intended by him to be mere allegorical statements. These people were actually eating food sacrificed to idols. And yet they were also identifying themselves as being Jews. John, however, called them liars. They were not Jews. And these verses in the by the Apostle John, when understood literally as they properly should be understood, are powerful references that fit representatives of the Samaritans to a T. John was very concerned with the Samaritans and their false teachings. Indeed, it has long been noticed by many Christian scholars that John's gospel has a decided Samaritan theme to it. And true enough, at the very end of his first epistle, he left his readers with his main concern. In 1 John chapter 5 and verse 21, he says, little children, keep yourselves from idols. And the heresies mentioned by John in the book of Revelation also reflect very decidedly those of the Samaritans as viewed by John and the rest of the apostles. Well, the upshot of the whole thing is this. When the Jews were in good and prosperous times, as their condition would have been just before 70 AD, before the war with the Romans, when most of the book of Revelation was written, before 70 AD, the Samaritans were prone to reckon themselves as being Jews. They wanted to be Jews in order to share in the prosperity then being afforded to the Jews at that time. There were then reasons when it was an advantage to be acknowledged as being Jewish or to be looked upon as being Jewish. But when the Jews were in distress or unpopular or under persecution by the Gentiles, at whatever time, the Samaritans customarily abandoned their Jewishness and stated they were Gentiles. And what irritated the Apostle John so much with those falsely calling themselves Jews and who were associated with the synagogue of Satan was their continued practice of performing what he considered to be idolatrous acts. Revelation 2 and verse 14. And this was no allegorical accusation. He warned his readers to keep yourselves from idols. 1 John 5:21. So the Samaritans were prone to mix pagan practices with those of the Mosaic law. Simon Magus taught certainly such things. Since Simon wanted to have a part with the apostles, in other words, to be an apostle himself, as is talked about in Acts chapter 8 and verse 21, his rebuff by the apostle Peter may have made Simon Magus to begin his own career and claim his own apostleship from God. And recall that the apostle John also censured those in the book of Revelation, talking about in Revelation 2 and verse 2, those who say they are apostles and are not, and have found them liars. The statement is so similar to those where he mentioned the people who say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan in Revelation 2, 8, and those who say they are Jews and are not, but do lie, Revelation 3, 9. These combined strictures smack of Samaritan influences upon first century Christianity, and that the Apostle John was trying to combat it. Indeed, anyone living in the Middle East in the first century would have thought that these combined statements of the Apostle John in his gospel, the epistles that he wrote, and in the book of Revelation would fit the Samaritan heretics in a definite way, and to Simon Magus and his teachings in a specific sense. And note this important point. Since the Samaritans customarily worshipped in synagogues, just like the Jews, each week in their homeland, it could well be that they did the same wherever they settled in their extensive diaspora over the Roman Empire. There can be no doubt that this is the case. On the island of Delos in the Mediterranean Sea, archaeologists have found the ruins of a Samaritan synagogue. This island was a major intermediate point where many vessels would stop in their travels to all areas of the Mediterranean Sea. But this fact does not end the matter. Another Samaritan synagogue was found in Thessalonica, where the Apostle Paul spent a great deal of time preaching the gospel. And this is talked about in J. Shibby's Zion, a Samaritan Synagogue in Salonika, 1977, page 42, volume 42, pages 103 to 109 in Hebrew. And it is a matter of importance to pay close attention to the various synagogues in which the Apostle Paul discussed theological matters when he was on his journeys. Note that when he came to Thessalonica, the book of Acts makes the statement that the Apostle Paul went to the synagogue to teach. Luke called this particular synagogue the synagogue of the Jews in Acts 17 and verse 1. Now, why does he add the phrase of the Jews? It could well be that in Thessalonica there were other synagogues besides those which belonged to the Jews. And now archaeology shows us, it's in that same reference, that there was indeed a synagogue of the Samaritans in Thessalonica, and a Samaritan community may have been there from the first century. Look at this point for a moment because it bears an important relationship to our present study. Suppose a person of this 20th century went searching for a synagogue or synagogues in any city or town in Europe, Africa, or the Americas. If any synagogue were found, and there would be plenty to be found, no one would have to say that those synagogues were synagogues of the Jews, because everyone knows that all synagogues in the world, except two Samaritan synagogues that still remain in the country of Israel, would be, quote, of the Jews, end quote. Furthermore, if a person today saw a menorah, the seven-branched lampstand of the temple, positioned as a sign of identification in the window of a home, at an office, or in a synagogue in such areas of the world, it would immediately be reckoned as an unmistakable sign that the places were Jewish. But in the first century, in many regions of the Roman Empire, this would not be the case. Samaritans also met in synagogues in this early period and used Jewish types of symbols. Now note this. In many cities of the Roman Empire, where the Apostle Paul went on his journeys, such as Antioch of Pisidia, Athens, Corinth, and Ephesus, Luke, in the book of Acts, simply stated that Paul went to the synagogue. Those were buildings where worship and discussions concerning religious and social matters could be held. This is where Jews and many proselytes met and discussed religion. Both groups worshiped there. The concluding phrase, of the Jews, is not mentioned by Luke as associated with these synagogues. But when Paul went to the island of Cyprus, Luke specifically stated that he went to the synagogue of the Jews in Acts 13 and verse 5, where apparently Jews alone had control and where there was a specific Jewish worship. Also, when Paul fled to Iconium from the major city of Antioch in Pisidia, it says in Acts 14 and verse 1 that he went to the synagogue of the Jews. And later, when he left Thessalonica in Acts 17:1, he then went to Berea, where there was also the synagogue of the Jews in Acts 17:10. The fact that Luke singled out these particular synagogues as being synagogues of the Jews is a very interesting point, and it may have been significant to Luke. Remarkably, however, when Paul got to Athens and went to the synagogue there, Luke refers to it as simply the synagogue that was adjacent to the marketplace where many people met for assembly. Luke stated that Paul immediately began to argue with the Jews and other worshipers about the worship of idols that the whole city of Athens was engaged in doing. Acts 17, verses 16 to 17. And when one reads the Greek carefully in these two verses, it indicates that the synagogue, as well as the marketplace, had idolatrous things associated with it. After mentioning the rampant idolatry in Athens, the book of Acts states, therefore indeed, meaning, or accordingly, or because of this, therefore indeed, he, meaning Paul, began to reason in the synagogue with the Jews and the worshipers about that very idolatry. These latter worshipers, who met in the synagogue of the Jews were not necessarily whom the Jews would call proselytes to Judaism. These worshipers with the Jews could be any group of people who met at the synagogue to worship or to discuss religion. And in this particular synagogue, Paul began to argue with those synagogue worshipers about the idolatry that was beginning to creep into the precincts of the synagogue itself. So this synagogue of Athens may not have been a synagogue of the Jews alone, but a general synagogue for Middle Eastern peoples who congregated with those of the marketplace to discuss all matters of religion and philosophy. This event mentioned in the book of Acts appears to be the very first historical indication, to my knowledge, of some idolatry creeping into a synagogue, and Paul having to argue with the Jews and other worshipers about the encroachment. But let us not forget that the book of Revelation tells us about some synagogues in Asia Minor where certain people of the synagogue of Satan were eating meats offered to idols. The Apostle John twice stated that those people who seemingly did those things were those who say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Revelation 3 and verse 9. And thus, the New Testament provides us with some essential keys that can be used to understand the history of the years just succeeding the times of the apostles. The book of Acts, as well as the Gospel of John, with of course the book of Revelation, gives us the prime information in helping to identify the people that history forgot. And what is now happening? Archaeology has come to our aid, and remains of buildings now prove that there were indeed Samaritan synagogues, where the Samaritans went in their dispersion within the Roman Empire in the periods following that of the Second Temple and the time of the apostles. And it is now appropriate to look at the evidence to show this. And this will be in chapter 6, Samaritans in all parts of the empire. It must be remembered that there were Samaritans scattered all over the Roman world in the first century of our era. Only recently have historians begun to realize just how extensive the Samaritan population was in central Palestine, but also in Phoenicia, Egypt, Arabia, North Africa, Syria, Asia Minor, Greece, and even in Rome and throughout Italy. At first, many Romans, when coming in contact with these Samaritans, simply thought them to be a Jewish sect, and often they were classified as Jews on that account. Indeed, some early fathers of the Christian community continued to confuse the Samaritans with Jews from the 3rd to the early 5th centuries, and I will show this in a moment. After all, the Samaritans carried with them wherever they went. They carried their doctrines and their religious symbols, which were in many cases the same as the Jews. As for the major population of the Samaritans, recent studies suggest that there were as many as half a million Samaritans in central Palestine in the first century, and about three times that many in other areas of the Roman Empire and other areas mentioned above. Look at Alan Crown's book, The Samaritans, from 1989, page 201. The 2 million Samaritans in the first century represented a large group of people to the Romans, and they would have been politically important to the government of Rome, as well as to their neighbors who lived near them and or among them. So what happened to that population of Samaritans, which numbered up to 2 million people in the time of the apostles, and for the rest and for the next 600 years that followed? And this is one of the things I hope to show in the remainder of this book. This vast number of people have simply disappeared from history. And that is, they have vanished as far as being denominated as Samaritans. Today, the number of identifiable Samaritans, clearly so, is drastically reduced to a small community. There's about 600 of them still living in two locations in Israel, in Nablus and near Tel Aviv. Now, some in Nablus, Dr. Martin says, I have come to know personally during my many times that I have been to the area. And they have told me that they have early records of their forefathers showing at one time there were Samaritans all over Europe, as well as Egypt, North Africa, and even India. They once represented a large population of the Roman world, and they became influential among the Romans. This dispersion of Samaritan peoples to many areas of Europe and even Asia has been known by the remnant Samaritans who still live in Palestine. As long ago as 1865, Robert Mimpriss, M-I-M-P-R-I-S-S, in his Gospel Treasury, Expository Harmony of the Four Evangelists, published in New York by Dodd in 1868, this book stated, quote, on page 545, in ages past, we find them, talking about the Samaritans, inhabiting various cities in Palestine and extending even to Constantinople. There was a tradition among them that large numbers of their brethren were dwelling in various parts of the world, in England, France, India, and elsewhere. And they have written concerning them from time to time in the hope of becoming acquainted with these, their brethren. Now, back to Dr. Martin. The evidence in the 20th century for a large Samaritan dispersion has become certain. In the new book referred to above, Alan Crown's The Samaritans, we have some following quotes and observations. In page 201, Crown says, Egypt and Phoenicia, North Africa, Greece, and even Rome all offered refuge or homes for Samaritans as well as for Jews. Observers made little distinction between Samaritans and Jews. On page 207, Crown says, Samaritans appear to have been located in every major coastal city of Palestine, and we find them in Italy and throughout Asia Minor. In pages 59 and 60, Crown says, we are aware that early in the Byzantine period, Jamnia, once the seat of the Sanhedrin, was almost entirely Samaritan. There were dense settlements in small farming villages across the Sharon, Shephela, and into the hill country of Samaria. Page 209 by Crown. Samaritan troops seem to have served in the Roman Empire and may have settled overseas, even at the frontiers of the Roman Empire. And of course, they would have been auxiliary troops and not part of the legions, although at later times they may have been. Page 211 by Crown. At Thessalonica, the Samaritan community was sufficiently large to have maintained a synagogue, one portion of which was named the Tower of the Samaritans. Page 212. Before the coming of the Muslims, the Mediterranean basin was virtually ringed by Samaritan settlers. Some as freemen, including merchants, officials, artisans, and colonists, and others as slaves, including, apparently, a large number of mine workers. Page 213. In the Mediterranean basin, this Samaritan diaspora was lost to sight forever soon after the Muslim conquest, with the single exception of a Samaritan refugee at Trieste in the 18th century. Well, in summation, Crown states that there were Samaritans in the city of Delos in the 2nd century B.C., in page 202, in Thasos at the same time, page 202, in Rhodes, Athens, and the Greek islands, page 202, in Sicily in the 1st century. There they had Samaritans in a community that lasted until the time of Gregory the Great, Pope in 6th century A.D., also in page 202. There were many in Egypt, page 203, and at least a third of the population of Caesarea in Palestine in the 1st century was Samaritan, page 206. And in the same amount, there were in the early Byzantine period, page 208. And importantly, there were Samaritan synagogues spread over the whole of the Samaritan diaspora, page 207. And there are three major factors which must be understood by historians of the Samaritan people. Firstly, that from the 1st century to the 6th century of our era, there were at least 2 million Samaritans in various parts of the Mediterranean basin. Secondly, in many cases, the Samaritans were confused with the Jews as far as the Romans and others were concerned, because the Samaritans used many of the same symbols that the Jews used in identifying themselves. Some examples of this confusion between the Jews and Samaritans are found in the quotes from early Christian scholars. In the early 3rd century, Hippolytus said the Sadducean branch of the Jews still existed, but they were then residing in Samaria. He said this sect had its stronghold, especially in the region of Samaria. This is in Hippolytus' Refutation of All Heresies, Book 9, Section 24. Origen, in his book Against Celsus, Book 1, Chapter 49, and even Jerome, in his commentary on Matthew 22:31-33, he thought the Samaritans were a Sadducean sect of the Jews. Epiphanius, in the 4th century, also confused Samaritans with Jews. And McClintock's and Strong's Encyclopedia says in Volume 9, page 287, Epiphanius, in his book Against Heresies, Book 1, considers them to be the chief and most dangerous adversaries of Christianity. And he enumerates the several sects into which they had, by that time, divided themselves. They were popularly, and even by some of the fathers, confounded with the Jews, insomuch that a legal interpretation of the gospel was described as a tendency to Samaritanize, or to be Judaistic, end quote. And even some of the Jewish authorities in the Talmud accepted some Samaritans as proselytes, although in most cases it was recognized that they were basically heathens. This is in the Kiddushim 75b and 76a. And the third factor to consider is that these Samaritans throughout the empire, just like the Jews, were accustomed to meet in synagogues and to use burial grounds that other Eastern peoples used, including the Jews. Recall that the followers of Simon Magus and his successors, who became identified with the Gnostics, they were also meeting in synagogues. It should be noted that just because the ruins of a synagogue are found that go back to the period from the 1st to the 6th centuries, it is precarious business to assume that it is always Jewish. Now, Richard Plummer in Crown, who edited the book The Samaritans, Reinhard Plummer makes the proper observation that the few remains from synagogues in Lower Galilee do not necessarily mean that the synagogues were Jewish. He suggests that in some cases they may be Samaritan, even when the square script of the Hebrew letters is used. And this is in page 156. Now, there is no proof whatever that the Samaritans always used the ancient script, while the Jewish authorities always used the square script from the time of Ezra, 5th century B.C. onward. In fact, with the Jews, the opposite is the case. Jewish coins from the Maccabee period, those at the time of the First Revolt, and even those coins minted at the time of the Second and the Final Revolt of the Jews against the Romans in 132 to 135 A.D., even they were inscribed with the ancient script. Some writings from the Dead Sea are also written in the earlier script. So that earlier script had a tradition of usage, even though it was considered archaic. Perhaps they thought it was more holy or something. And in Jerusalem, in a burial cave at Givat HaMivtar, is a Herodian period inscription in the ancient letters written by a Jew who had just buried his friend. And this is in Joseph Neva's Early History of the Alphabet, pages 120 to 121. All this shows that there remained a penchant among Jews to use the older script alongside with the later square script. And while the Samaritans seemingly continued to use the old script for making manuscripts of the Torah, there is every reason to believe that they often resorted to the square script in other literary environments, such as on tombs and dedicatory inscriptions. And this is clear in S. Safrai's Samaritan Synagogues in the Romano-Byzantine Period, Cathedra number 4, page 86 in the Hebrew. And speaking of tombs or cemeteries, just because there are found inscriptions or carvings that suggest biblical themes from the Old Testament, this is no guarantee whatever that the tombs and the cemeteries are to be reckoned as exclusively belonging to Jews within mainline rabbinic fellowship. In many areas, the identification of certain cemeteries as being Jewish or Samaritan, etc., are often based on literary sources that mention Jews or others as living in the region. And this is fine, but in the region of Lower and Upper Galilee, the literary sources are not sufficient to properly identify either synagogue remains or the cemeteries. Galilee was a pluralistic society. As Professor Crown reminds us, in the area of Scythopolis and Beth Shean, where some of the synagogues of which we have been speaking are located, there was an important Samaritan population as well as in Sepphoris, in Upper Galilee, and in the Decapolis. This is in the book Samaritans, page 60. In such pluralistic societies, it was common for all religious groups to use, in many of their inscriptions, the normal languages spoken by the ordinary people. And thus we find Greek and Aramaic writings in the synagogues, and we should expect such inscriptions in burial grounds and commercial buildings and in homes. Artifacts and religious objects would also be inscribed with the normal speech of the community. And this is what was found. Goodenow found such inscriptions all around the Mediterranean area. And if they showed any Jewish types of symbols and had what he considered Jewish names or themes, he would most often classify them as Jewish. And this is understandable. But with what I am presenting in this research, we need to be careful of such identifications. And let us not forget that there was a large Samaritan population in Galilee, and they also had an extensive diaspora, which was scattered all over the Roman Empire. And these Samaritans were often mistaken as a Jewish sect. And it is this continual confusion between the two peoples that is important in our present study. The confusion even extended to racial appearances. When the Jerusalem Jews were upset with the teachings of Jesus, they looked him over and said, "Say we not well that you are a Samaritan?" In John 8 and verse 48. And now Jesus was clearly Jewish and reckoned to be from the house of David. But the Jewish authorities, they felt it was proper to call him a Samaritan. And had the two peoples looked dissimilar to one another in physical appearance, they would not have been able to make such a comparison of Jesus. The simple truth is, the Jews and Samaritans at large often resembled one another in physical appearance. This was another reason for the confusion between the two peoples. And what we need to ask, however, is what happened to this large group of people called the Samaritans, who seemingly by the 7th century disappeared from the face of the earth. And this is what we need to look at in this historical survey. And when we do and believe what the evidence reveals, we will realize that the Samaritans are the people that history forgot.
Wow. That's a great presentation, David.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Very fascinating material.
And mysterious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's go on to chapter 8. I think we have time on this.
This is what chapter?
I'm sorry, 7.
7.
My mistake.
Okay.
Yeah, chapter 7. And this is called The Samaritan Synagogues in Galilee. And we're going to talk about synagogues specifically in Galilee. And once again, these are Dr. Martin's words. And though there were many similarities between the Jews and the Samaritans, and outsiders commonly considered the two groups as sects of one religious family, there were, in fact, some major differences between the Jews and Samaritans. The Samaritans were much more prone to mix pagan doctrines and artifacts into their worship of God than were the Jews. And this may be, in part, this may in part account for the fact that Simon Magus was able to make greater headway among his own people than he did with those who were mainline Jews. This also allows us to understand how the early records show that Samaritans in their dispersion were more easily converted to Christianity, at first to Gnosticism and then to Catholicism, than were the Jews. They were also inclined to bring with them into Christianity their syncretistic religious doctrines, their mixing of pagan beliefs with those of the Holy Scriptures. We are even told by the Samaritans themselves in the early chronicle of theirs that in the 4th century, one of their priests went to Constantinople, and he was a nephew of the famous Samaritan leader called Baba Rabban, and he became a great skopos, and that is an archbishop, an episkopos, in another way of saying it. In the Catholic Church, he became a great skopos, an archbishop in the Catholic Church, and that he even crowned kings and emperors at Constantinople. This reign of Baba Rabban was an important high point in Samaritan influence in the eastern part of the Roman Empire that we now call Palestine. It is important in our study to realize that this Samaritan chronicle about Baba Rabban has to say, because it contains information that only recently has become available for scholars to study. And thankfully, we now have the part of the chronicle about Baba Rabban translated into English by Jeffrey Cohen. This Samaritan chronicle contains a great deal of excellent information. It mentions a time when the Samaritans gained considerable power under the rule of the Samaritan priest named Baba Rabban, who ruled for about 40 years in Palestine. This is in chapter 10, section 12. Though the chronology of the Samaritan document is not clear in some parts, it is known that Baba Rabban flourished somewhere near the time of Emperor Constantine. And indeed, the document states that Constantinople was, at that time, the capital of the Roman Empire. And during Baba's time, it states that the Jews started to rebuild the temple at Jerusalem, which would no doubt have been in the time of Julian the Apostate, who was emperor of the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Empire at that time. This information leads us to the 4th century, about 365 AD, around that time, for the period of Baba Rabban. But there are other scholars who feel he flourished in the previous century because of the mention of some 3rd century emperors that are noted in the text. In my view, the mention of Constantinople as the capital of the Christian world at the time of Baba Rabban, and that the Jews started to rebuild the temple during his reign, appear to be substantial reasons to accept a 4th century data for the historical events associated with Baba Rabban. Whatever the case, the Jews were in a weakened condition politically during the time of Baba Rabban. And the Romans were having their own difficulties in the wake of the conversion of the empire to Constantine's Christianity. Baba Rabban took advantage of the situation. He appeared on the scene in Samaria and gathered the Samaritan people together into a relatively powerful force all over Palestine. The Samaritan people gained a great deal of influence and authority over Baba Rabban. And this is important in regard to our present study because the archaeological remains of several synagogues in the general area of Galilee that caused the Jewish scholars of the past few decades a great deal of perplexity to come from a period within 100 years or so after the time of Baba, and they may be considered as being inspired by the extensive building of synagogues under the Baba Rabban. The Chronicle, it's also known as the Samaritan Chronicle, tells us that at this time, many Samaritan synagogues were built in various parts of Palestine and Galilee. This is in both Book 12, section 12, I'm sorry, Book 10, section 12, and also in Book 9, section 9, and section 19. In fact, the influence of the Samaritans at this period, when the position of the Jews was weaker, extended to most areas of Palestine and even northward into southern Lebanon. In this extensive area, controlled by Baba Rabban, he built quite a number of synagogues. The Samaritans began to come back into a fortunate time during the rule of Baba Rabban. Before mentioning what the Samaritan Chronicle relates concerning the rule of Baba Rabban, let us recall some important points in regard to this area of Galilee. There were many types of people who lived there in almost all eras. From the 8th century BC onward, and even in the time of Jesus, the region was known as it says in Galilee, in Isaiah 9 and verses 1 and 2, and Matthew 4 verses 14 and 15, the region was known as the Galilee of the nations. Normally, there was a pluralistic society of peoples who lived in that area. And from the last 100 years of the patriarchate of the Jews, from the time of Constantine's conversion in AD 329, when the patriarchate ended, 329 AD, the Jews found themselves in a weakened political position wherever they were. And this is when the authority of the patriarchate was at its lowest. In the early part of the period is when Baba Rabban and his Samaritans appeared on the scene with more political power than they had ever known in any previous time. And the question is, who built those synagogues in Galilee with the pagan decorations, along with the symbols of the tabernacle? Well, interestingly, the general time those synagogues were built is not long after the period when Baba Rabban and his successors flourished over all areas of Palestine. And this included the region of Galilee and even up to Sidon and near Tyre. And this is in section 10.16 in the Samaritan Chronicle. To this day, Baba Rabban divided Palestine into 11 administrative regions, and two of them embraced Galilee, with the city of Tiberias being a major area in the political designations. This is in section 9, chapter 9, and chapter, or section, book 9, section 9, and section 19. So the Jewish population came under Baba's authority at that time, book 10, section 12. And most important to our present study is the fact that Baba Rabban built many synagogues in the region that he controlled. Book 10, section 12. It appears very possible that the remains of the synagogues showing the pagan symbols may well have been built by the Samaritans and for Samaritan use during the time of Baba Rabban's successors. So what is remarkable is the similarity of the synagogues, one on the south side of Tiberias, two in Beth Shean, and another not far away, called the Beth Alpha Synagogue. The Torah shrine is similar in all synagogues in several respects. And this is in Marilyn Chiat's Handbook of Synagogue Architecture, page 108. And interestingly, the synagogue classified as Beth Shean A, this synagogue is designated by the letter A and the other one by the letter B. But A has among its ruins a Samaritan inscription, and it has led some scholars to surmise that the synagogue was a Samaritan one. This is in Cheops, Handbook of Synagogue Architecture, page 131. And why not? In those synagogues were found artifacts and symbols that the mainline Jews were condemning in their literature written in the period of the Talmud. Not only were there pictures of pagan gods, but there were found even seven-branched menorahs. Indeed, Goodenow in his volume cataloged a multitude of seven-branched menorahs on lamps, graves, etc. The making of such objects, which belonged only in the temple, were prohibited by the authorities who were mainline Jews. There are three passages which are practically identical in the Talmud, which states that no one should make a house like the temple, or a table like the sacred table in the temple, or a menorah, the seven-branch lampstand, like that in the temple, or of whatever material. This is in Menahoth 21b, Abodah Zarah 43a, and Rosh Hashanah 24a and b. And to avoid such imitations, it should be stated that one may make a menorah of 5, 6, or 8 branches, but not one of 7. And though Jews 1,000 years later began to use the 7-branched menorah occasionally, there is still a reluctance among certain groups to do so. If a menorah is seen today, it is most often a 9-branched lampstand. And the fact is, in the Talmudic period, the mainline Jews were prohibited from making a 7-branched menorah. And this prohibition, however, did not influence the Samaritans, who did not consider themselves to be under the authority of the Patriarchate of the Jews. When one finds 7-branched menorahs sketched on synagogue walls as though they were officially placed there, or on any other artifact which can be dated to the Talmudic period, one must suspect such designs as not being mainline Jewish. One should be careful in classifying such archaeological remains as Jewish until an exhaustive and extensive survey can determine them as actually being Jewish. Remember, the Samaritans were as active as the Jews in many areas of the Roman world, and especially in Galilee, and such Samaritan influence must be considered as well. The synagogues in Galilee, with their zodiacal, the signs of the zodiac and pictures of heathen gods, could very well be Samaritan in origin. Indeed, as I have already shown, there is a Samaritan inscription found in the Beth She'an synagogue, the one designated as A, and it also has an inscription stating that the craftsmen who did the mosaics in the synagogue were responsible for the mosaics in the Beth Alpha synagogue. This is according to Kiat, Handbook of the Samaritans, page 131. The truth is, these synagogues with the pagan motifs have credentials for being Samaritan synagogues built when the power of the Jewish authorities in Galilee was at a low level. In other words, they had very little influence at the time of Baba Rabban, and more probably in the period of his successors. So the confusion that always existed in identifying the two peoples, Jews and Samaritans, was recognized even by the Apostle John in the New Testament. the confusion was continued by the early church fathers as late as the time of Jerome in the early 5th century A.D. Excuse me. And even today, the confusion in identifying artifacts and other archaeological remains of the two peoples is still in evidence. One must be very careful in evaluating the remains in ancient synagogues and burial grounds. One cannot simply call such things as being Jewish because they have Old Testament themes associated with them. The Samaritans and the Gnostics from Simon Magus also met at synagogues and used biblical symbols as well as pagan in their religious services. Utmost caution should be displayed by the archaeologists regarding such items before making final decisions on such important questions. Indeed, it could well be that some of those synagogues in Galilee were constructed by the people that history forgot. And that ends chapter 7, George Ann.
Wow.
Chapter 8 is fairly short. Should we go for 4 here?
Yes.
Okay. And chapter 8 is titled, Many Samaritans Become Christians. And once again, these are Dr. Martin's words. It has long been recognized in psychological circles that once a people give up their national religion for one that is truly universal or Catholic, that's what Catholic means, is universal, and that they abandon their former religion while away from their national homelands, the people usually become reckoned as converts to a new society altogether. In other words, when Samaritans who were scattered in great numbers around the Roman Empire gave up their Samaritan religion, which was tied to Mount Gerizim in central Palestine as their central place of worship, similar to Jerusalem, where the temple was, they then become Orthodox Catholic Christians. They came to be known as belonging to the people of the land in which they were converted. For example, if Samaritans who abandoned the religion of their homeland took up a belief in Orthodox Christianity while living in Italy, they became, from that time forward, Italian Catholics. Those in Spain became Spanish Catholics. Those in France became French Catholics, etc. Their loyalty from then on was to their local bishop, or to the Pope as an overall authority. And they ceased to be called Samaritans from then on. The same thing happened to individual Jews who were converted to Christianity, Islam, or whatever religion throughout their history. For one to accept Catholic Christianity wholeheartedly and to abandon all forms of his former Judaism meant that the person would blend into the normal Gentile society around them, and they would love all the signs of their, and they would leave all the signs of their former Jewishness. On the other hand, if they simply accepted Jesus as the Messiah and still retained much of their Jewish ways, such as meeting on Sabbath, eating kosher foods, etc., they would normally be called Messianic Jews, or some might call them Jewish Christians. It all depends on what the converts retained from their old religious beliefs. If Jews or Samaritans simply abandoned all their connections with the Mosaic belief and attached themselves fully to Catholic Christianity, then they would have lost their former identities and become known as the same people as those within the lands of their conversions. This is especially true if they indiscriminately married into the local stock of people, and their descendants doing the same thing in future generations. All of this is a well-known phenomenon. But it is important for us to realize this point if we hope to discover what happened to the great number of Samaritans who made up the people of the Samaritan homeland and their diaspora from the 1st to the 5th centuries of our era. So let's look now at the issue. Recall that Simon Magus blended a type of Christianity, Judaism, Samaritanism, and paganism into a single system that came to be called Simonianism. And then it became known as Gnosticism when they abandoned the name or title Simonian. Then Gnosticism itself was supplanted by Constantinian Christianity, which in turn became known as Orthodox Catholic Christianity. The first mass conversions of the Samaritans from their traditional religious beliefs was when they went over from the teachings of Simon Magus in the 1st and 2nd centuries. When they went over to the teachings of Simon Magus in the 1st and 2nd centuries. The whole nation was affected with the doctrines of Simon Magus, if we are to believe Justin Martyr, himself a Samaritan. Allowing for some exaggerations on the part of Justin, it is still reasonable to believe that many Samaritans were converts to Simonianism, later to be called Gnosticism. This meant that the teachings of Jesus began to take on new meaning to them, and though they interpreted the teachings of the gospel in a Gnostic manner of belief. Then, in the time of Baba Rabban, we find this priest himself as head of the Samaritan people, sending his nephew to Constantinople to secretly become a Christian as a means of saving the Samaritans from any Byzantine persecution. The nephew became an archbishop who was able to crown even some Byzantine rulers, if we believe that what the Samaritan Chronicle records. And a little later, in the years of Arcadius, 395 to 408 A.D., quote, were years of ease for them, meaning the Samaritans, in which they continued to embellish their new synagogue buildings, end quote. And this is by in Crowns the Samaritans, page 68. There can be no doubt that the Samaritans were actively constructing synagogues during their times of prosperity within the Byzantine period. And from this time onward, we find several references in Byzantine literature and in laws about the Samaritans. The evidence shows that the Samaritans were quick to be converted to Christianity if the need arose. But they were prone to retain their old ways and were not in the main truly converted in the Byzantine period to their newfound faith. They became what the records call crypto-Samaritans, and some of them began to assume great power and authority in the Byzantine governmental structure. Aviona called these crypto-Samaritans a fifth column on behalf of their brethren wherever they were found. This is in his book, The Samaritan Revolts, pages 127 to 132. As an example of what the Byzantines thought of the Samaritans, Procopius, the chief historian of the 6th century AD, gave an account of the Samaritans of Caesarea in the time of Emperor Justinian. The emperor, who persecuted non-Christians, found that the Samaritans did not think it profitable to endure any distress over mere doctrinal beliefs. In the words of Procopius, they discarded their old name and called themselves Christians, And this is in Procopius' Secret History, Book 2. Procopius later mentions a native Samaritan by the name of Arsenius, who was a close friend of the Empress Theodora, who had become very rich and powerful in Palestine. He was even made a senator in the Roman Senate in order to hold on to this powerful office. Arsenius, quote, decided to call himself a Christian, end quote. This is in Procopius' Secret History, again, page 27. If the Byzantine records, there's section, chapter 27, if the Byzantine records are anything to go by, it must be reckoned that the Byzantine rulers looked on the Samaritans, the ones still calling themselves Samaritans, as being much like the Simon Magus of the Book of Acts, and that they had little trust in any of them. Like the Apostle John had said of them in his day, that they were reckoned themselves Jews, but did lie, so it seems that they also began to call themselves Christians, while not really accepting the pristine teaching of the gospel as it referred to conduct or to doctrine. So lax in their religious duties were the Samaritans that in the 6th century A.D., Justinian II made a law requiring a 2-year trial period for all Samaritans who wished to become Christians. The laws that were issued about the Samaritans from the late 4th century to the 6th century A.D. were primarily suggesting that they were the source of the Gnostic movements which had afflicted Christianity. And the Samaritans were looked on with great skepticism and caution. However, vast numbers of the Samaritans, especially in their diaspora, converted to Christianity from the 4th to the 6th centuries A.D., and they disappeared from being Samaritans any longer. They married into the local populations wherever they were and became known nationally from then on by the name of the region where they converted. The final demise of the Samaritans is a major group of people with their own religion centered on Mount Gerizim in central Palestine. The final demise was the conquest of Islam. When Islam became a major power in the former home territory of the Samaritans, it became easy for them to take up the Muslim religion as they had the Christian faith earlier. It was with the Muslim invasion that we lose all track of the Samaritans, who formerly accepted Gnosticism, and then Roman Christianity, and then Islam. The few remaining Samaritans that held tenaciously to their own form of religion, which was mainly a Mosaic belief, with their holy mountain being Mount Gerizim, diminished remarkably. So far did they decline in population that by the time of Napoleon, about 200 years ago, they had fallen in number to a mere 200 souls. And now, at the close of the 20th century, they are back to about 600 in number. And the rest of their brethren, who formerly went by the name Samaritans, have long disappeared when they converted to Christianity or Islam. In a word, many Samaritans in their European diaspora became converted to Catholic Christianity. This merging caused the racial and religious identity of the Samaritans in Europe to disappear. And when Islam came on to the scene in the early 7th century, many Samaritans in the Muslim world adopted Islam and also disappeared as a distinct Samaritan group in race and religion. Indeed, it is almost certain that the Muslim population around Nablus and in central Palestine today are mainly of Samaritan racial stock who now call themselves Arabs or Canaanites. The Samaritans who resisted the triumph of Catholic Christianity and Islam and a conversion to those faiths, of the vast numbers that lived in the first to the sixth centuries A.D., are those 600 people who live in Nablus and near Tel Aviv in Israel. They maintained their identity because they were a small group who would not give up their conservatism and continue to hold on to the law of Moses and Mount Gerizim as their only authority. Only a few of the remaining Samaritans continued with Moses. The rest of the Samaritans have disappeared from the records of history. And with the absorption of the Samaritans by the Roman Catholic Church in Europe, and with the Samaritans being engulfed by Islam in the rest of the world in which they settled, they have disappeared from history and have become a major part of the people that history forgot. But the Samaritans are not the only ones who should be considered from a historical point of view. There were other nations who were neighbors to the Jews and Samaritans, and they must be considered as well. And the next chapter, chapter 9, will explain this point. So thank you, Georgianne, for this opportunity to present these four chapters
This has been very informative. Excellent material, David.
Stuff, most people have never heard before, unaware of.
Right.
And even scholars, apparently, are unaware of much of this information because Dr. Martin brings together information from disparate sources.
Sources, yes.
And, puts it together in a new way that is not against, it's not fantastic information. It's not fantastic material at all. And so we'll get into more of this later next time.
Good. As an aside, do you know in 2014 they are making a federal law that they can no longer teach literature in school?
Literature?
Yes.
Or liturgy?
Literature.
Literature at all? In other words, Shakespeare?
Right. If you teach Shakespeare, you'll be fired. You'll lose your pension. Yeah.
Huh. What about colleges?
It's federal law. It's all across the board.
Oh, I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
I'm
working on getting a copy of it. I mean, this is devastating.
Well, that would be insane, and it would drive most people to, more and more and more people, not most, but more and more people to, homeschool or
yeah.
Have private school.
They'll have to. Oh.
And then, I would be very interested in seeing that, so look forward to that.
Okay, David. God bless you, and God bless everybody out there that's paying attention and listening, and thank you. Good night.